Well, good evening and welcome to the live stream event on the 21st of January 2020. I'm Martin North, the Principal of Digital Finance Analytics. Great to have you on board and really good to have so many people on. You know, many people are still away thanks to Christmas, New Year holidays and all the other things that have gone on. But nevertheless, we've got a good crowd mustered and hopefully we'll see a few more coming on as we proceed as well. So I won't spend too much time welcoming everybody now. We've had quite a few people on already and we've had a few conversations in the pre-show, so that's great. So what I'm going to do is to start the process in my normal way. So during this part of the presentation, which is just giving you some background information, some latest details, I'm not going to look very specifically at the chat. So if you've got specific questions for me, things you'd like me to talk about, just hold off and I'll come back to the chat after I've done that. So I hope that that makes sense. So what I'm going to do is just go through the introduction and from there we can then take the story forward. So just in terms of the running order, as normal, this will be this introduction. There'll be some house rules, just as normal, about our models, some key slides, some questions and answers, and then we'll sign off. This normally takes about maybe an hour, maybe an hour and a quarter, maybe an hour and a half, depending a little bit on precisely how many questions we get and what issues people would like to talk about. Just go back to the main camera and then I'm going to go this way. There we go. So you can now see me and the slides at the same time. That's the new switcher working. One of the great investments I made last year, thanks to the support from the people on the channel, was a bit of tech which really makes the presentation, I think, come alive. So that's pretty good, hopefully. Okay, in terms of house rules, please note this isn't financial advice. I'm not able to give financial advice. I'm not qualified to. I don't know your individual circumstances. This is based on my general understanding of what's going on, my own analysis, but it isn't financial advice. If you want to get more detailed advice, go talk to a financial advisor. Please play nice in the chat room. No racial slurs, please. We are moderating the stream quite actively. We have had issues in the past with people doing things we really shouldn't see on the channel, and they will be removed. But the fact is we've got a really great community here, a lot of really smart people with good ideas and good questions and good answers. So let's use that and let's not play any racial slurs. This is as at today, 21st of January 2020. As I always say, you know, if you're watching this 2 years later, things may be very different from what I think it is now. But that's just the way the cookie crumbles. If you want to get my attention, please use at Walk the World. There's lots of conversations going on the stream. Many people there, many conversations going. I won't necessarily pick them all up, but if you use at Walk the World, you will be sure of seeing and getting my attention, and then I can give you my thoughts against your thoughts. We've enabled Super Chat, so that means that if you want to ask a specific question and make sure it gets seen, or if you want to make a donation to a DFA, you can use the Super Chat facility, pretty painless. It really does make a difference. And I should say that I have decided that all revenue I generate from the DFA channel through the month of January will be directed directly to the bushfire appeals. So I'll tell you more about that at the end of the month, but I'm hoping that we can throw some money towards the fires and towards some of the relief agencies for the areas of the country that have been really badly affected by the bushfires. So January is going to be bushfire support month on DFA. Now, just in terms of our models, there may be some people who haven't come across the way we think about the world. So we run a series of surveys, customer surveys, SME surveys, broker surveys. They're running all the time, and they go into our core market model. The core market model is our piece of analytics that basically runs information that we feed into the channel, information that runs into our scenarios, information that runs to our client assignments. And that core market model is containing at any one time 52,000 households with all of the data attached to them. So it's quite granular, quite detailed. And that means that we can then slice it and dice it, think of it like a Rubik's Cube, which means that we can look at the data through different property lenses, through different geographic lenses, and through different segmentation lenses. That gives us a very powerful set of insights. And we then use those, for example, to drive our mortgage stress analysis, our household confidence analysis, and other analysis too. Now, let me just touch on a few data points. The Fed, of course, is still supporting liquidity. The repo thing is still going on. They've done some reverse repos as well, which is sort of cancelling out some of the early ones. But nevertheless, net-net, the Fed is still building its balance sheet. And the Fed is going to say, I think, for the next few months, they're going to be running the repos. But this is suggesting that it's not just a short-term issue, but a strategically structural issue. And we may touch on that in one of the questions later on. In terms of the MIFO, 2 points to make on that. The first was that the Treasury downgraded its outlook for wages growth again. They're absolutely appalling at getting the wages growth anywhere close to where it actually is. Wages growth is very slow for many people. It's been no growth at all since 2013. The other point is that they down forecast the surplus. And they also made the point, and this is the real killer for me, that real spending per person is expected to go backwards over the next 4 years. Now, that is a remarkable and unusual thing. In other words, the government is spending less in the MIFO per capita than a few years ago, and that is remarkable. And even then, the cash balance was $5 billion, down forecast from $7.1 billion. But, of course, that was before the bushfires. The bushfires, in my estimation, could cost $30 billion over 3 years. There are other people out there saying $100 billion. Who knows? The initial $2 billion, of course, is already earmarked. More will probably be earmarked later. Now, of course, that could potentially become stimulatory later. So it may well be that... Vanessa, thank you. I really appreciate that contribution. Thank you. The $2 billion, will actually lead perhaps to some stimulus, but I suspect that the surplus is looking a bit shaky now. And indeed, Frydenberg today, I think, pretty much conceded it might not be possible to achieve it. Too many unknowns, I think, to know for certain. There's, too much of a repair job still to be done. Disposable income still going backward. This is from the OECD data. Australia is pretty much the the only country way below the rest of the OECD in terms of gross disposable income per capita. Basically, what it says is that we, as individuals, are actually not doing very well. Because we're growing the population so strongly with the migration, nearly 300,000 over the last year, the total pie is getting bigger, but the contribution per capita is actually going backwards. And that, I think that's a bit of a concern in terms of we're, filling the place up with more people, but not necessarily creating more at the end of the day. Unemployment still sitting at about 5% and is likely to rise. The latest Roy Morgan data, which came out very recently, showed that the ABS unemployment is at 13.5%, but their measure, which is an alternative measure, is at 18.6%. We have a lot of people with not enough work. We have a lot of people unemployed and underemployed, and that's going to be a very significant issue, I think, down the track. Mortgage stress, which I reported on a couple of weeks ago, is as high as it's ever been. It's now 32.7%, well over 1 million households. It's a reflection of flat incomes, rising costs. And despite the fact that mortgage rates are lower, more households are getting a difficulty. And there's a strong correlation, as somebody asked on the chat beforehand, between mortgage stress and not paying your rates. So there's some rate arrears in some of those areas too. Sentiment is on decline. That's true for the business area. Roy Morgan confidence came out today and is down, way down from where it was. And also consumer confidence is way down. Now, that's a combination of the bushfires, poor economic news, flat wages, probably a bit of a crunchy Christmas as well, all of those things together. And the fact of the matter is that confidence on both sides of the house, both in business and consumer land, is actually looking pretty bad at the moment. And that doesn't bode well because the Reserve Bank and the Treasury are pretty much banking on house prices leading to consumers to spend more because they need household consumption to grow. Without it, the budget is going to look pretty sick ahead. Building approvals and dwelling investments are still falling. The data from November from the ABS and also the housing prices and construction dwelling investment, both down, way down. And that tells us that we're going to see limited activity in the construction sector, probably more construction jobs disappearing. There's a million workers in the construction sector. Not all of those are now full-time employed. Many of them will have difficulties later. So it's a pretty significant issue in my view. Vehicle sales are down again, 10.6 from 2017. Interestingly that SUVs are still growing, but a lot of the other ones aren't. So that's a significant issue. And by the way, vehicle sales sliding is not just an Australian thing. It's something that we see around the world as well. So the whole automotive sector is under a lot of pressure at the moment. And that's people not able to afford to buy new, not wanting to buy, thinking they might take an electric car later, and a bunch of other things too, all going on together. Exports were surprisingly strong. So in trend terms, the surplus in November was 5.39 billion, which was a decrease a little bit. But nevertheless, it's pretty strong. But it's supported, obviously, by metal ores and coal. And I have to say also that the stronger dollar that we've now got is not helping, because, of course, we mean it translates into a slightly smaller number. So we're going to have to watch these numbers carefully, because essentially, if you look at the way that the economy works at the moment, businesses aren't investing, consumers aren't spending, the government is spending big, and of course are now doing the bushfire remediation work, and then the other is actually the exports. So we're still generating significant revenue from our coal and from iron ore, particularly iron ore. And of course the question there is that demand going to continue, or will the likes of China and elsewhere begin to actually demand less ahead? So we'll have to watch that, I think. So the economy is looking a bit shaky in my view. So the question is, and this is of course the big question that everybody comes back to, you know, it's what the Reserve Bank and what the Treasury are betting on, that it'll be home prices that will magically save us. So essentially the idea is that if you can cut rates, lend people more, they'll go buy more houses. Once they've bought those houses, they'll go spend at the shops and, you know, buy more new furniture and those sorts of things and do renovations. So it's a very narrow, myopic strategy. And the question is, will it work? Well, so far, if you believe CoreLogic, you know, the indices are up relative to 3 months ago. Of course, they are still down from peak, so we're still not back to where we were. But the other interesting thing, again, if you believe the CoreLogic data, the rate of growth, which is the chart on the right, is slowing. So the question is there going to be a huge amount of steam in the property sector over the next few months? I've got my doubts. I also am not sure that these CoreLogic numbers are really telling the full story. I think they're rather distorted on low volumes of transactions, and the fact that there's been a distortion in the market towards the top end, where there are more transactions than perhaps normally relative to the rest of the market. And that's skewing the results, because if you look at some of the other providers of information like REA, then the data is nowhere near as strong at the moment. The ABS, by the way, uses CoreLogic data, so not surprisingly that ABS and CoreLogic are pretty much aligned. But that rate of growth, which is continuing to slow, we'll go on reporting that, because I think that'll be an important leading indicator. The other thing to say is that the latest lending data, this is trend data to November, shows that new loans are actually still growing, but they're growing slower than they were a few months ago. And that's whether you look at unoccupied, whether you look at investment lending or lending to first-time buyers. So it'll be interesting to see whether the first-time buyer incentives turn that around at all. But to my mind, it looks as though lending is probably easing back. And I've had some reports from some of my industry contacts that whilst there's been a lot of inquiries about mortgages, when it comes to actually making applications and getting those applications approved, the volumes are relatively low at the moment. That may change in February when everyone's back from holidays, but that's what I'm getting at the moment. The final thing to make is that the latest data from the RBA showed that net payments are lower. So this is the interest payments to income ratios. It's down to 6.5. That's, of course, all households, so it doesn't necessarily tell you the full story. Now, that's a combination of low interest rates, but also it's a combination of many people paying down their mortgages because they're uncomfortable about the current situation. They're not sure about what's going to happen ahead. And all of the lending data is definitely skewed by the fact that people are paying down. So there was about 16 billion of tax refunds and other tax cuts. a good proportion of that was just put straight into repaying mortgages. And by the way, I think that's a very sensible thing to be doing. So there are many cautious households out there, many people who are preferring not to borrow more at the moment. And the other day I went through some of that in my household surveys, if you want to look at it in more detail. Now, let me just talk about our scenarios briefly, and then I'll come to the questions and answers. So one of the things we do is to run our scenarios each month based on all the data that's come in, and I'll go through that now. Now, the scenarios is a way of looking at different futures. I'm not saying that any of those are going to be right. It's not a forecast. There are too many variables to make a clear forecast as to whether X or Y will happen. But it'll be a way of representing the relative probability of different outcomes. So I use the framework from our core market model, and then I look at five potential outcomes. But I've made a change this month. I'm now basing the forward projections on the current situation that we're in, whereas previously I was running it from a baseline of middle of 2018. So that means that there will be some changes in the scenarios today relative to last time. And I'm going to continue to do that. So each time I bring the scenarios back, the model has now been adjusted so that it baselines from where we currently are. So it hopefully may be more useful and less confusing to people. So there are five scenarios. The first is the business as usual scenario. So that's what the RBA is saying. Now, I interpret that based on the data as to what I think is most likely to be achieved. So it won't be the same as the Reserve Bank data, but it's not far off. Then I've got one that things suddenly get better, and that is a less good scenario. So that's where unemployment's higher. That's where the economy doesn't fire as strongly. But then we've got not yet doomsday, which is a more severe version of that. Mostly driven by local factors, and that's where I've taken account of the bushfire impact. The Armageddon, which is Ireland 2.0, is more an international financial crisis, and what would happen if we had one of those, particularly when banks were being bailed in or bailed out. And then Doomsday, which is Iceland 2.0, is a scenario where essentially banks are allowed to fail. And just like in Iceland, they went through a very deep decline, but then sort of started to recover. And if you compare Iceland and Ireland today, Iceland is actually in a better position. So this is the current scenario based on what the Reserve Bank. I think that over the next 2 to 3 years, we're going to see the Reserve Bank rate down at 0.5% in this scenario. Unemployment about 5.5. Mortgage stress higher than it is at the moment. It's 32, it's up to 34. Losses a little higher. But there is still growth in house prices over the next 2 to 3 years in this scenario. And that's because of a combination of very loose lending standards, a combination of very low interest rates, and the fact that there is still some latent demand for property, particularly from owner-occupied property buyers and from first-time buyers. So that's enough to put a floor on property prices. I've also included in this scenario negative interest rates. So I think that negative interest rates in consumer land, unlikely possibly, but negative interest rates in terms of central banks to the retail banks, definitely. And that will encourage the central banks will encourage retail banks to lend more. And that means that they'll be desperate to make those mortgages. And that means that we will see further easing of the credit rules. Now, I give that a 30% probability, which is higher than last time. So basically, I think that there is a route from where we are forward to higher home prices. Only in that scenario. The more adverse scenario, again, is with a Reserve Bank rate of 0.5%, but a higher unemployment rate, higher mortgage stress as a result of it. The losses now start to accelerate. We're at a significant tipping point with regard to bank losses. We've already seen arrears rise a little. If the mortgage stress rose significantly, then that's going to put much more pressure on the bank losses. In this scenario, there is not enough that can be done with regard to fiscal stimulus, quantitative easing, and negative interest rates to support house prices. So in this scenario, over the next 2 to 3 years, you'd see home prices perhaps go up a little, but then slide down and probably be lower from where they are today. And typically, I think 10 to 15% would be where we are in about 3 years' time. So there's a 25% probability of that one. So you know, without wanting to over egg the cake, there's a big gap between, you know, going up, going down, and it's highly sensitive to the interaction between the Reserve Bank, negative interest rates, fiscal, and also the credit rules that are actually put in place. Because there's still a strong latent demand for property, It's just a question of whether people will be able to and want to commit themselves. Remember that we've got some of the highest debted households in the world. We've got some of the biggest mortgages in the world. The housing affordability report that I reported on yesterday made that point that, you know, Sydney, Melbourne, even Adelaide, Perth, totally unaffordable relative to many other places around the world. So we're already maximum out. So the question is it conceivable that the debt can be increased sufficiently to support the economy and then home prices, or will it all go terribly wrong? The next scenario, which is essentially when we've now got significant issues, the Reserve Bank will probably have to cut rates even lower, 0.25%. The unemployment rate will probably have a 6 in front of it. The mortgage stress will go higher. The losses will be higher at the banks. And now we've got this sort of reinforcing negative cycle where home prices could be 20 to 30% lower than where they are today. If that happens, there will be at least one bank who will need a bailout or a bail-in or something, because it will not be able to cope with that degree of home price slide. And I give that a 20% chance. So it's a reasonable call, but it's not my base case or my best case at the moment. Then we've got the international crisis. So this is basically the Fed, for example, fails to support the US economy and the US economy goes into recession, or China falls over, or one of the other international crises boils up, could be in the Middle East. And as a result of that, the financial stability that is sort of underpinned at the moment by very low levels of interest rates and a lot of quantitative easing and other activity around the place effectively fails. So we go back to where we were a decade plus ago around the global financial crisis. So rates will be very, very low, could be as low as zero in real terms. The unemployment rate would be significantly higher. Mortgage stress would be very high. The bank losses would be very, very difficult to cope with. And home prices would drive down further. So, you know, there's a 30 to 45% scenario here. And just to explain, just so everybody's clear, if you take a fundamental view, building up the value of property from land, what it takes to build, and all those things, and add in amenity value, prices on average in Australia are still overvalued by at least 40% on any of the measures, whether you look at income to GDP, whether you look at price to GDP, all the other factors. So this is just getting us back to a more normal level of home prices. There'll be bail-in, there'll be bail-out, there'll be QE2. That will probably include mortgage backed security purchases by the central bank as well to try and support the economy. And in that scenario, 20% I think is what I give it. So what I'm really saying to you is I think there's a 20% chance that the global financial system will essentially fall over in the next 3 years. And then I just should give you the last one, which is effectively the zero and below interest rate scenario in the doomsday. Now, this is where effectively we have significant bank failures, quantitative easing, but we allow the banks to fail. I think it's highly unlikely in Australia that banks will be allowed to fail. At the moment, and indeed all around the world, it looks as though central banks' mission in life is to keep the financial system going at all cost, never mind the cost of real people. And therefore, I only give this a 5% chance. But if it was to happen, then we could see very high levels of unemployment, very high levels of mortgage stress, and dramatically, dramatically low home prices. Don't give it a huge ratio in terms of my probability. So you can see that in the round, you know, more than half of the view is somewhere in those first two. And, you know, we're vacillating between those two as I take account of all the issues around the bushfires and the other information that's coming through. But at the moment, I see those scenarios probably the ones that are more likely to play out rather than the international financial crisis ones, which are there firing in the background. But nevertheless, I don't think will necessarily come to the fore. But I have said, and I will continue to say, I think 2020 will be a very significant year. We will know more at the end of this year as to which of these scenarios is likely to play out. Okay, so I hope that's given you a little bit of a flavour of what I've been thinking and the way the model's been working. What I'm going to do now is I'm going to come back to look at some of the conversations, some of the questions. I've got a load of questions that I received earlier as well. I should say, just so you know, I get around 300 messages a day through the various channels, including a bunch of questions. So what I've tried to do in the questions that I've got preloaded is to sort of summarize some of the questions that I had many times. But I prefer to go with questions on the live stream first. So let me just go back and see what we have. Okay. A lot of questions. So Andy asks, could the bushfire event be the Black Swan event? Well, there's no doubt in my mind that the bushfires is a very significant event. And look, I make no apologies for spending a bit of time over the last 3 or 4 weeks making posts on aspects of the bushfires. So there was a post that I made trying to estimate what the real costs could be. I come up with about $30 billion, and that's based on looking at what happened in Victoria a decade ago, which was about 1/6 to 1/8 the size of all the bushfires down the East Coast. Remember, of course, the bushfires are still burning even now. But what I'm also interested in is things like the tourist dollar. So I'm doing some work at the moment to try and estimate the total tourist dollar. There's about $46 billion that's international tourism, and a bigger number, about $79 billion, relating to interstate and local tourism. Now, that includes tourism for education as well as holidays. So if you actually strip it back and then just look at the holiday dimension and then overlay which part of the country is being affected, directly, it's not a huge number. But indirectly, it may well be people choose not to come to Australia. They might go somewhere else. And all the pictures of Sydney and Melbourne and Canberra and other places with the smoke wouldn't help. So you can run some scenarios to say this could actually be quite significant. Of course, there's also a significant investment now that the government's putting in, the $2 billion. Some of that money will flow directly into the local economies. Some of it will be probably invested in other ways. And of course, there's going to be a considerable claim to the insurance sector. We already know that many of the insurance companies will need to reactivate their reassurance arrangements. In other words, the first tranche of risks are taken by the insurers, but then the rest is actually shared internationally through the international insurance networks. That could actually, by the way, have an influence on the dollar as the money flows in. And we think that those numbers are going to be quite big as well. So in the Victorian event, of the 4.4 billion that was spent in total then, about one point something, more than a billion was actually under insured, 1.4 billion I think was under insured losses. So on that same ratio, we could see, you know, maybe 10 billion of insured losses. That's a big number. That could have a real big impact. Also, of course, having a big impact on insurance premiums. I expect insurance premiums to go up substantially for everybody, not just in the bushfire areas. The other point to make is that many people who are insured will be underinsured or won't have full insurance or any insurance, and that's going to have a big deal. And of course, banks have first dibs on any insurance monies if there's a mortgage, so that could be another factor. So all of these things are quite complicated. And on the other side of it is, I think this has changed the atmospherics with regard to an understanding or a perception around the climate and how it's changing, the fact that it's very dynamic, much more dynamic than normal. We saw huge thunderstorms here the other day, massive hailstones, in other places, in other areas like in Canberra. There's just more dynamic stuff going on, and that's going to have a significant long-term negative impact. And indeed, the IMF and the World Economic Forum today made the comment that one of the biggest risks to growth in the future is the much more aggressive weather that we're getting. Now, whether that's created by man-made climate change or other factors, another debate for another day. But the net effect is that this could have a significant drain. And I keep saying to people, don't assume that these bushfires are a one-off event. We could be in the same boat next year and the year after. And so, yes, this could definitely be a significant trigger to significant negativity in terms of the economy, in my view. Okay, let's have another look. A few people from Perth come in. Hi, good to see you. Where's John? Yes, good question. I don't know. I think John Adams may or may not be on the stream tonight. I'm not sure. A few other things going on. So gold, silver, cryptos, doomsday coming without a doubt. International risks will play a major role. Yeah, well, that's the point, right? So there is definitely, Very interestingly, again, the IMF and the World Economic Forum have both called out the international context, and they talk about the trade situation. So I know that there's been a phase one trade agreement with China and the US, but it's, you know, very small beer, really. Okay, they've agreed not to accelerate tariffs further, and China will spend $200 million in the US, which, by the way, may mean that they will use some of that money in the US rather than, say, in Australia. But they haven't solved the fundamental issues. And, of course, there are other trade issues going on around the place. I think, though, it is linked directly to the Fed and the repo situation and the fact that the Fed's having to pump more in. Now, I don't think the Fed will lift rates. Neither do I think they will cut rates, so they'll keep rates where they are. But they will continue to put more money into the system. Now, whether this is quantitative easing in the natural definition of it or an extended definition of it, you know, I'll argue that another day. But the net effect is more money is going to the system. They can't stop it, because if they did stop it, then effectively we would trigger a liquidity situation, in my view. So, yeah, I agree. The international stuff, pretty difficult to cope with. A lot of factors there. I also think the international issues around, you know, responding to the weather and those sorts of things will be very significant. I mentioned BlackRock the other day. BlackRock, of course, has announced that they are focusing now on sustainable investments and are withdrawing, for example, from thermal coal. And I know that some of the miners announced quite recently that they're going to stop investment in more thermal coal. They're only going to focus on coal relating to steelmaking, for example. So there's a bunch of things going on, some of those internationally, some of them locally. But the international context is really, really important to understand, which is why, by the way, on our weekly updates, the Property Imperative Weekly, we always start with the international context. You can't look at Australia in isolation. It's one of the biggest mistakes that I see when I speak to people, is that they somehow think that we're sort of insulated and cocooned. Remember, well, there's a net 1 billion of 1 trillion, I should say, of international debt. Remember that we are totally reliant on international investors investing in Australia and Australia being regarded as a safe place to put money. If that changes, then essentially we've got big issues. We'll find that the dollar will dive. We'll find that the premium we have to pay for funding will rise. And that will have a very negative impact, which is why, in fact, inflation is still a risk in the medium term, in my view. So Cookie Boy says going to 0% by the end of the year. 0% from the RBA or 0% in terms of central banks to the retail banks? I think the way it will work is that the Reserve Bank might leave rates around 0.5%, but then what they might do is to start charging the banks if they don't actually use the funds that are available from the central bank to lend. That's what has happened in Europe. Fortunately, it hasn't worked. So if you look at what's happened in Germany and in the ECB, for example, this hasn't increased lending. It hasn't actually worked. What it's done is it's pushed more of the bank's activity into speculative trading activities. And interestingly, Goldman Sachs reported last week the centre of growth was trading revenue. So that's derivatives and those things. Those are really risky things. So this isn't necessarily going to lead, in my mind, to smarter lending. And that's a problem. So Biber says, are negative interest rates contagious due to the effect of exchange rates on exports? If the EU does, then it pushes other countries towards negative rates. Yeah, well, you're right. So that's a really important point. So, yeah, there is a race to the bottom, right? Because you can't effectively move too far out of the range. Otherwise, as you say, the exchange rates gets messed up. And so the race to the bottom in terms of negative rates is actually a real risk. Now, it's interesting that the EU is currently reviewing their monetary policy and their negative rate policy. And you may have noticed that the German 10-year Bund has actually moved up. It's not quite in positive territory, but it's close to. What's fascinating to me is that there was a huge amount of bonds issued, particularly in Europe, with effectively no coupon over a long period of time. And they were taken up by a lot of banking sector operators and hedge funds. because they believe that they would have certainty over, say, 20, 30 years, right? But half of that is now out the money, because basically as interest rates rise, then the bond price drops. And so I have a theory that one of the reasons why we've got all of these issues with the Fed and repos is that we've got a lot of people sitting on bonds that are actually in negative territory, which means that when they come to mark to market, that's a big loss to them. So I think that's a big deal. And I think those international movements in terms of rates and how the rates and exchange rates work will force rates lower, unless we get some concerted change of policy across multiple jurisdictions to say, actually, negative rates aren't working. Now, Sweden, for example, lifted rates after having spent 5 years in negative territory. Only a little bit, but they've sort of said, we don't think it's working. And there's questions now in Europe as to whether negative rates could work. My own analysis of negative rates is they don't really make any difference. They actually put more pressure on households. They put more pressure on the banks. They don't actually create the real momentum that people are after. So to my mind, the negative rate strategy is a busted flush already. We'll see. But if it continues to run, then it's likely that more will go further negative or risk the exchange rate. So Rolf said, yeah, hopefully people bought gold a year ago. Yeah, well, you know, if you bought it a year ago, you probably are doing reasonably well. I know there are a few people who've bought it more recently and are looking a little less comfortable at the moment. But interesting, what I find interesting about gold is the fact that it's moving in the same way as the stock markets. Normally, gold moves in the opposite direction. So when stock markets crash, gold goes up because it's seen as risk-free and, you know, it's a safe haven. But at the moment, we've got the stock markets rising and we've got the gold price rising. That's really quite unheard of. And I think that's a signal of this stimulation through very low rates and the liquidity stimulation that we're seeing. Remember, of course, and I keep saying this, gold prices are as highly manipulated as exchange rates or interest rates because of the futures markets and because of the multiple leverage through the derivative sector. So don't think of gold as a risk-free alternative. There are as many risks attached to gold and indeed silver as to interest rates and to other commodities and stocks and shares too. The risks are different, but nevertheless, in the current environment with the movements up, some of that is artificial in my view due to the very low interest rates and to the liquidity that's flowing around the market. Yeah. So Kiwi Andy says, any sudden change upward in the rates and boom. Yep, you're right. If rates were to move up, and there are situations where you might have to lift rates. So, for example, the exchange rate dropped dramatically, and I'm still thinking the exchange rate will be closer to 60 than 70 in the next 2 or 3 years. If it goes further south than that, then rates might need to be lifted. Remember, we also risk importing inflation as well, and that's another factor which people need to bear in mind. Okay, what else have we got? So Vanessa says Europe to go into recession first. It could well. Europe is looking shaky. Although, interestingly, there was some not bad data coming out of Germany. It looks a little better than some people said. And the IMF latest report that came out today was a little bit more bullish on growth in Germany, Europe, and elsewhere, other than emerging countries. So the reason that the overall growth number went down over the next year or two is because they're worried more about India now. India, another big economy, but looking as though that's going to slow more than previously. So lots of moving parts. Now, it's an interesting question, of course, and I keep coming back to this. Can you consistently have the growth at the levels that you would aspire to in a world that effectively is running out of, you know, some resources and, you know, all of those things? There's a real question in my mind as to whether the growth agenda that is fundamentally wired into the way that central banks and policymakers are all connected to are actually driving off a cliff in a way. I wonder whether we need a different set of measures. So GDP, I think, is a very bad measure of anything useful. Are there alternatives that might actually give us a better, more balanced set of outcomes? Something about well-being, possibly, or, some other factor that measures more what it's like to be a real normal person in this world rather than actually the the metrics that seem to drive weird behaviours that might support the banking system, might support large corporations, but many people just get caught in the crossfire. Okay, okay, very good question from Skynet. Do you know the percentage of zombie companies on the ASX? Yeah, very good question that. So what we do know is that there are many companies who are able to borrow at very low interest rates because rates are so low. And many companies are doing two things. Firstly, what they're doing is using those funds, those cheap funds, to buy back shares to lift their prices, the price on the market. So they look as though they're doing well because the share prices have gone up. Really, really significant in the US. So one of the reasons why prices are so high in the US is because of massive amounts of buybacks. But the other is that that stops capital flowing to the companies that want to invest and should be investing. So effectively, you end up with a series of companies that aren't able to really thrive and survive. Now, I've done a bit of analysis on this, not all of it. But it looks to me as something like 15% of companies on the Australian ASX probably would be categorised in that zombie category. In other words, they shouldn't really be there, but they're there simply because of the artificial situation and the fact that the rates are so low. But they're not actually adding value, they're not being productive. I'd also add that quite a lot of the growth in the economy, of course, is to do with things like services to the elderly and to the health sector. And those are really valuable things in terms of the people that they're actually supporting. But in terms of creating value, it's actually just moving a dollar. It doesn't actually create a dollar. And the thing that I come back to is that we're not investing enough in companies that are really creating value and essentially lifting the the total contribution back to the economy. We've got a lot of companies who are just moving the dollar from A to B to C to D, but essentially clipping the ticket on the way through. And those are actually less productive. And, if you take that view, then the zombie number could be a lot bigger. Okay. What else have we got? So Sydney I was talking about money printing will blow up. Yeah, there'll be a lot of that. It's the simple logical thing if you're a central banker to say, well, we'll just print a bit more. Nobody seems to mind. We'll just create the the illusion of wealth. But the illusion of wealth is not the same as wealth. So what happens when you print money? Everything gets devalued. So the value of things may be going up in terms of the number of zeros, but the real value is going down, and that's what tends to happen. So we've seen that. So you might think home prices are going up, but they're not really in an absolute sense. In fact, if you look at what proportion of income is required to service a house today relative to 10, 15, 20 years ago, it's a lot higher now. It tells you something. It's not real value. It's just an artificially inflated number. So because of that, they'll go on doing that until they basically run out of steam, and then it all goes terribly wrong. Okay, Krish says, given the low cash rate on deposits, should we put our cash in private vaults and then not worry about deposit insurance in case of the downturn? Well, that's a really interesting question. So, there are people who I get messages from who've, say, I've got some money and I want to spread the risk. So they sort of put it in the, across a series of banks, maybe credit unions, building societies, keep below the 250 cap. And in the normal course of business, that will at least give you some certainty, although, of course, you get very, very low interest rates. Trouble is, it doesn't necessarily deal with the bail-in scenario. And John Adams and I have been running a series of shows on interest of the people relating to bail-in. Deposit bail-in is real. It may not happen, but it could happen. And if it does happen, essentially we could see some of those deposits then nicked and basically used to support the banks. It's clear in New Zealand, it's clear in other places, it's as clear as mud here in Australia. But bail-in is not necessarily something to sort of completely ignore. So then what do you do? Do you pull money out of the banks and hold it in cash? Well, if you look at Japan, that's exactly what they did. So in Japan, most people started buying safes, pulling money out and holding it. And in fact, it's something like 25% of all the notes are actually in circulation. The rest of it's being held by people at the moment in Australia, according to recent research that was done, which suggests that there are already people hoarding notes. And one of the things you might well see is the Reserve Bank reducing the supply of large notes to try and sort of stop this. Now, you've got to link this to the cash ban, right? So one of the things, of course, that people need to wake up to is that the cash ban would make illegal movements over $10,000 initially between companies. But that particular issue is actually in the regulation, not in the bill. So they could change the regulation and then suddenly you couldn't pull money out or in the bank above 10 grand. So you've got to think about, you know, in a really bad scenario, is that something that could happen? Well, it happened in Greece, where effectively people couldn't get money out of the bank. They could only take a few, you know, a small amount out on an ongoing basis, and they were bailed in. So those sorts of scenarios that are thought about. So then, well, do you then forego any value on those notes? Do you then store them somewhere? Well, some people may choose to do that. Of course, you don't get any growth in the value. So if inflation runs away, then effectively your value is eroded. So other people will say, well, I'll go into gold. And like I said, well, gold is an alternative. But the thing about gold, again, is that it has the same characteristics as many other speculative assets, insofar that there is a huge derivatives market connected to it. So the price is not actually connected to the underlying directly. And therefore, you could see the price manipulated up or manipulated down. So you're not necessarily isolating all the risks and exposures. So if you decide just take the money out of the system and hold on to it, the Reserve Bank won't be very pleased, because they actually want you to spend that money rather than hoard it. One of the reasons why, in the negative interest rate environment, they might make it difficult to pull money in and out the bank, because they don't want people hoarding it, they want people spending it. Now, I have the view that if I've got money, it should be my choice as to whether I spend it or whether I don't spend it, and where I put it in the bank or whether I put it somewhere else. But if they basically close in and stop us doing X, Y, and Z, understand the rationale. It's to try and force people to spend. Why? Because they need that spending to support the economy. And that's the underlying logic, which I fear is driving a lot of the behaviour of the central banks around the world. Okay. Yeah, the new SARS, Vanessa, interesting question there. Difficult to know whether it's, you know, really going to have a significant impact. It's too soon. But, you know, there are models out there where they actually take account of, you know, an international pandemic, and that can knock a significant amount of stuffing out of the global economy. So it's another risk to add to the list, I fear. Okay, let's have a look. What else have we got? Okay, I'm just going to go quickly and have a look at some of the other questions that I had beforehand, because there were some really good ones here. So Chris asked about bail-ins for the Bank of Cyprus, where 47.5% of deposits above 100,000 euros were actually bailed in. So given that, can you comment on whether you feel higher deposit holders in Australia are at greater risk than lower deposit holders? Yep, I think they are. So my view is that if they did do some sort of bail-in process in Australia, they may well allow the first tranche not to be bailed in, but higher tranches definitely. Don't know where the limit would be, but I think that's quite likely. And you're right about the reason they might do that. Firstly, of course, it reduces the number of people hit. So from a reputational perspective, you know, it might only be 10% of people holding large deposits. So if you're holding small deposits, then no issues, which simply means that from an election point of view, it wouldn't necessarily have a significant impact. Because if you took everybody's deposits, then you've got 3 million people in Australia who would be extremely annoyed and may well vote you out next time. So I think there's that political lens to think about. The other interesting question is, which you sort of go on to talk about, is the fact that the deposits, could well be a bit of a linchpin in terms of the political environment. So if in fact people did have deposits nicked, it could actually reduce the trust and all of those things. I think this is a big issue, and so it becomes a bit of a tussle between the trust and the individuals and how that all plays out. I don't know. I'm not sure how it will necessarily all work, but, you know, that's sort of my thoughts on that. So, Chris, just to answer the rest of your question, taking from those who are more affluent could be politically less damaging than taking from all citizens with deposits in the bank. Correct. And it's potentially a much wider audience. Yep, correct. And he went on to say, can't get enough of your videos. The unbiased, data-driven critical analysis is such a breath of air. Fresh air. Chris, I appreciate that. Thank you so much. I really do take that on board, and I do appreciate it. Okay. Joe. Interesting. Joe asked, wondered if Joe Wilkes was coming back anytime soon. Missing the more detailed coverage of New Zealand, though thanks for covering the main points in your general posts. What is your view of the New Zealand market given the strong rises even in Auckland? Yeah, I connected with Joe today. Not sure whether he's on the stream or not, but we might well be able to get Joe to come back. He's been really, really busy. So that's the reason why he hasn't made any posts. But I'm still trying to twist his arm to come back. I know that a lot of people who really like his insights. We have tried to cover New Zealand through our other posts. There was one yesterday, which looked at affordability in New Zealand. At the weekend, in my interest of the people, weekly post, sorry, in my Saturday post, the property imperative, I did look at particularly in the New Zealand data, because of course the data there in New Zealand is remarkably strong, 3.something% rise in Auckland. In New Zealand, what we're seeing is simply that the low rates and the loosening of credit standards has really created this. So just like in Australia, New Zealand is betting on the housing sector to support the economy, despite the fact that some of the other economic metrics look pretty shaky. So one or two more on New Zealand. We'll try and cover more either with Joe, or if Joe is unable to come and help me, I'll try and do some of it myself. Because I think New Zealand and Australia are really interesting comparable markets. They're the same but different in many ways. And, you know, interestingly, the affordability questions in New Zealand, according to the demography report that I featured yesterday, are worse than in Australia. Okay, I'm just going to do another question here. Mark, how will the bushfires impact the economy, and will the spillover effect on tourism and education be long-lived? The estimates of the impact vary significantly. Is the surplus $5 billion now? I sort of half answered that, but just in terms of, is this going to be a long-lived thing? I think it probably will be. My issue is that the reputation of Australia as a clean, green, fresh-aired place to come spend time has been trashed. It's going to be some time to recover that. Now, I know that what will happen, of course, is that the advertising, they're going to spend, I think, $75 million advertising, including interstate advertising and then some overseas advertising. The question is, will it be sufficient to bring people in? Just to give you one example, in China there's about $13 billion of revenue from tourism over the last 12 months, but $7 billion of that was actually relating to education. Now, if people decide not to come to Australia because of what they saw about the smoke in the cities and those sorts of things, that could be a big deal. And of course they make decisions not just on a few weeks basis, but a year or two or three ahead. So I'm concerned that this could definitely be a long-term issue. Plus, of course, the bushfires are still burning now. And if we don't get a lot of rain over the winter, we'll have the same issue or worse next time. So that's a really big issue. And my own view is that the $5 billion surplus is definitely shot. Now, let's go back to this a minute. Okay, gold, silver, cryptos. Can you please show how immigration has dramatically increased compared to the last few years from the ABS website? We need some data. Well, actually, I did a post the other week on that. So we're looking at around 300,000 migrants coming in at the moment. So the net growth in Australia is about two-thirds migration, one-third homegrown, as it were, right? And that migration has definitely been stronger more recently. And so far as I can see, it's a deliberate policy of this government to allow migration to try and grow the pie. The logical argument is we can't get GDP per capita to grow. I showed you that was going backwards. But what we can do is bring more people in. If we bring more people in, then the top line number increases. And there was some work done in the US quite recently. One of the feds in the US, they showed that it's really hard for Australia to have a full recession, a GDP in negative for two quarters, with so much migration. So actually, migration is being used as a quasi-quantitative easing strategy, right? So basically, it's pulling more people in and basically lifting the number. But of course, it's having huge impacts on population, on lifestyle, and all those things. And so, to my mind, the big Australia narrative, which is underpinning this, is flawed, completely flawed. I would be looking much harder at migration, because with the employment rate that we've got at the moment and the fact that wages growth is not rising partly because migration means that there are a lot of people who are able and willing to work for lower rates. So it's part of this conundrum. And by the way, don't also buy the argument that we need lots of new properties built because of this migration, because most of the people coming in as migrants are not able to buy property. They might go into rented accommodation initially. But the other point is there's a million empty properties across Australia. A million. And so essentially, there's more than enough already built. We don't need to build more stuff. And that's another of those myths that's been peddled by some of the spruikers and some of the developers. Okay, what else have we got? Adrian says, what is your take on land versus housing versus units? Is land a relatively less inflated and therefore less risky at this time? No. In fact, got to be careful. So as with all of these sorts of, you know, it depends. So if you look in Western Sydney, land prices are half what they were a couple of years ago. If you look in other places, land prices are still rising. And in fact, the Demographia report made the point that land prices are rising because in Australia and in New Zealand, what's happened is that they've controlled the amount of land availability deliberately to lift prices. So land prices are actually already extended. Then, of course, you've got the cost of building on top of it. And unfortunately, with some of the changes in building standards, the fact that the costs of, you know, employing people to build are rising, costs of building are rising as well. You know, you could think of land as a hedge, I suppose, and there are people holding land, just basically holding it for 10, 15, 20 years on the assumption that it'll go up. It may well, but if you held it in Western Sydney, you'd have lost a mozza over the last two or three years. With regard to units versus houses, I'm very sceptical of the current quality of unit construction from what I've seen. I've seen some of it firsthand. I've seen the cracks in newly constructed apartments. It's not that the building standards aren't right, but they're not being executed and enforced correctly, and the inspections that are being done are not actually up to scratch. Now, there have been some announcements today in New South Wales they're going to change some of that to try and actually improve building standards and make sure that they're actually adhered to. But we've got 20 years of poor construction of units in not just New South Wales, but in most of the centres across Australia. So that's a big deal. And so I tend to say to people, if you want, you know, a quiet life, I would look at houses rather than units. I also think that it's important where you buy, because essentially we know that there are lots of these cheap built houses with low standards on the new estates around the urban fringe. Some of those have lost significant value. Look over in Perth, we've seen prices drop 30%. I can show you other places in Melbourne and Sydney and Brisbane where prices are also falling. Closer in, prices are higher, more demand, less supply. And that's one of the reasons why we're seeing quite a lot of interest in houses closer into Sydney and closer into Melbourne at the moment. So that'll be a factor, I think, which will be quite important, seeing it. So I think be very careful. Also, you know, do the work locally. So wherever you decide to look, get local information. Don't just rely on these averages. So the CoreLogic average for Sydney is meaningless when it comes to looking at information down at a granular level. I know that prices are very different in different suburbs and different types of property. So it's important to get really granular to really make a decision. Right. So Slow Broking says, do you see the Aussie dollar continue to be weaker? I think it's very likely. So, you know, the Aussie dollar was up at 70. We've been at 67, 68, up to 70 and down again. But that's more to do with what the US dollar is doing. So the US dollar is extremely strong at the moment, and the economic information that's coming out of the US is pretty good. So the consumers were spending more. The inflation was a little better. The jobs numbers were a little better. That improved the US dollar. So if the US dollar remains strong, then the chances are that the Aussie dollar will continue to slide. And then you've got the local negative impacts on the fact that our GDP number will probably be weak again. I think the bushfires will have an impact on that. Rates being cut further probably at some point will all have that negative impact. So my modelling over the next two or three years is that the Aussie will be lower towards 60 rather than higher towards 70 or above. There's another reason, and that is that effectively that would give the Reserve Bank the ability to import inflation, and that would perhaps help them with their 2-3% target. Plus, of course, it would actually increase the value of money coming in for the exports that we ship out, so that would actually help the balance of payments as well. So there's a bunch of reasons why I think it's quite likely that the Reserve Bank would be more comfortable with a lower exchange rate. Of course, there are some consequences of that, and the risk is at some point confidence might get destroyed, in which case hyperinflation would sort of follow, and that could take us into a rather uncomfortable territory. So there's some parameters around how far you can take the currency. Okay, what else have we got? Okay, this is from Vincent. We're seeing big brands like Jeans West, Bordeaux, EB Games going out of business. Is this related to mortgage stress? What are you seeing in the data? Yep. So there's three things to say about this. Firstly, a lot of the retailers that are essentially going out of business are in the clothing sector. And a lot of those are being replaced by online purchasing. And some of the big international firms are selling here. So there's an international online aspect. The second is that consumers, particularly those consumers in some financial difficulty, so there's a million plus in mortgage stress, there are many others who are also struggling, don't have the money to spend. So they're being much more cautious about what they spend their money on and when they spend it. There's a couple of little things going on in the data. The first is that people are spending less, but when they spend, they might spend something a little more on something which is going to last longer. So the concept of, you know, buy it and wear it once and throw it away or pass it on has gone. So that's the second point. The third point is that the retailers that are actually reported, which are these big chains, are missing the point. I'm seeing thousands and thousands of small retailers, individual shops, also closing. So, for example, in my local area, we've now lost three in the last 4 months. And they were people selling fruit and vegetables, kitchen items, and household items, right? So it wasn't in the fashion sector. It was actually sort of more down-to-earth stuff. None of those were able to survive. And the reason they couldn't survive is that there wasn't enough people coming in on a regular basis. Some of that, again, is to do with online. But online is only, you know, a small percentage, sort of 7 or 8% of all transactions. So it's not like it's the whole story. So I think that's part of it. The other part I want to highlight, and it's the other thing that comes from my surveys, is that one of the other killers is actually the costs of running a shop, particularly around business rates. And I think we need to look at this very seriously, because a lot of people are not able to maintain the facility that they've got simply because of the costs, the fixed costs. So I think we need to look at that. And of course, we've also got wages costs and jobs disappearing as well. So I think the retail sector is going to go through a very significant transformation, but it's going to be very tough over the next 12 to 18 months. I don't expect Christmas to be particularly strong from all the data that I've seen. But I want to go back to these individual retailers, you know, the small shopkeepers, the you know, people just have one outlet. They're really feeling it at the moment, certainly in the outer suburban areas, certainly in the regional areas, and I suspect closer into Sydney as well. Okay, interesting question from Ecclusia, I can't necessarily pronounce that. Ecclusiarch, Ecclusiarch, or something. What is a safe home deposit percentage in the long run? That's a very interesting question. So, there's no one answer to that. In the good old days when I used to lend, I used to say 20% is a really good target. Two reasons. One is, if you get below 20%, you essentially don't have to pay lender's mortgage insurance, which is costs a lot of money. Secondly, it demonstrates that you have a capacity to save. And that's really important because it's the discipline of saving that actually, you know, you need to learn so that when you have a property, you can continue to look after it and also maintain your finances. And the third point is that that 20% gives you a bit of leeway if in debt, the property prices fall. Now, just to be clear, property prices can fall a lot further than 20%. In the UK, I lost nearly 30% of the value of my property there when we had a crash. So, but you know, 20% is a reasonable sector to go for. Now, of course, the government scheme is saying, oh, you just need 5%. I'm very worried about that, because I think people will go into buying a property too soon. They won't have the discipline of saving. And the problem, of course, is that gap between the 80% and the 95% is effectively a government guarantee, effectively. So the government's on the hook if prices fall. One reason, by the way, why they'll probably want to keep prices up. But I think that 5% is too low. It doesn't give you much in the way of wriggle room. But remember this, whether it's 20% or 5%, if prices fall, you lose first. So you lose your deposit before the bank loses anything on the mortgage. That's the way it works. So leverage on the way up, fine, but leverage also on the way down negatively. So 20% is what I'd shoot for. Okay. Now, Blistering Barnacles, lovely name. Captain Haddock, yes. What do you see as the most likely trigger event for a shift in inflation in Australia? You think the CPI is a valid indicator? No, CPI is rubbish. It was manipulated. It's been manipulated down, not just here, but around the world. So, for example, the cost of housing are excluded. There's a rental proxy, but that doesn't really work. A lot of other things have also been taken down. So, for example, there's this idea of equivalence. So, you know, when you if you buy a, I don't know, a car today, the car today has got lots of tech that the car in, you know, 10 years ago didn't have. So therefore, it's not like to like. So basically, you make some adjustments for that equivalence. Those things mean that CPI is understated dramatically. I think in real terms, the CPI is at least double the top level number that is quoted, you know, in the official statistics. That's one of the reasons why I'm being very frustrated, because, of course, if the CPI is, you know, not 1 point something, but it's 3 point something, which is what I think it is, then in fact it's above the RBA target rather than below the RBA target. So they shouldn't be taking rates lower to try and encourage more people to, you know, to spend. Basically, we're in a different scenario. So I think the CPI number is rubbish. It's rubbish in the US as well. It's a bit of a confection that allows the central banks to drive rates lower than they probably should. And the trouble is that, you know, with so many factors being removed, like the housing costs, it just bears little relation to real life. And, you know, when I survey households, I keep coming up with the same data point, that the real costs of just day-to-day living are significantly higher. And it's true whether you've got a mortgage or whether you haven't. It's true whether you're older or younger. So CPI is way off. And trouble is that if the exchange rate drops, we we might see CPI rising because of it, so we import inflation. That's not going to help. Okay, now this is a very interesting one. Can you explain the economic emergency clause that all banks have in the fine print? So there's a few things to say there. I just recorded today a post with John Adams for the Interests of the People channel where we go into detail on the fine print of deposits. And basically, in the last year or so, there have been some weasel words put in that basically gives the banks way more flexibility in how they actually deal with telling you about your deposits and changes to the terms and conditions. It gives them the ability to basically wash their hands if they need to do things because, you know, APRA says jump, or indeed because of their own risks relating to credit or other things. So there's a bunch of issues in those terms and conditions. Now, the interesting question, of course, is how many people have read their terms and conditions? I bet you haven't. So make a note. Go and read your terms and conditions. I mean, you know, they are very, very unfriendly, very un-user-friendly, but look for the ones that talk about in the event of X, you know, it could be in the event of a liquidity situation or a credit situation. There are clauses now which basically gives the banks a lot more flexibility and basically says you can't sue us if these events happen. So worth reading. Now, Rodney's asked, are CDIA bank accounts? You have to tell me what CDIA is, Rodney. I'm not sure I know. So, Vanessa's talking about energies distorted by government subsidies. Too right. Mining sector, massive subsidies. And guess who doesn't pay much tax? It's pretty disgraceful. We have an economy that's stacked. It's stacked to the benefit of big business. It's stacked by those in power to support certain sectors of the economy at the expense of we taxpayers. And I think I made the point in one of my other shows that if you look over the time, the proportion of tax paid by corporates coming down, the proportion of tax paid by us has gone up. And that's a problem. So, yeah, there's some big questions there about the structure and the equity in that. It's not very fair. Skynet says CBA apps have terms and conditions. You're right. Yes, you can get them quite easily. And they're not as long as they used to be. Worth reading. You know, a bit of homework to everybody. Read your terms and conditions. You will be surprised. Australian population could be 1 billion, says End the Resistance. Well, we have the landmass for it, right? But we don't have the infrastructure. We haven't got the planning. We haven't actually thought about big Australia. That's the problem. We're still muddling along. You know, look at the water. Look at the water issues. You know, we don't have enough water. We don't recycle water, all those things. There's no long-term strategic planning for the country, and that's a real problem. So we muddle from issue to issue. We sort of, you know, muddle around on a day-in, day-out basis. The point I want to make is if you really want to grow the size of the population, then there has to be long-term strategic planning, and we have to think about infrastructure, and we have to think about where people are going to actually go and how they're going to be supported. Look at some of the residential developments around our urban centres. There's nothing there other than just houses. So people have to just go in their car and drive all the time. Highly energy inefficient. There aren't the normal things that you would expect to find around a community. So they don't really have any community. So there are a bunch of issues that we need to think about if, in fact, we really want to grow our significant population base. You know, and that would mean thinking about water. People may be aware of the Bradfield scheme, which is you bring water from the north and bring it to the south. Well, maybe that's what we need. Big picture thinking, that means we need an investment bank that's there for the long term to build the infrastructure that we need to make Australia work as a larger economy. It's not there at the moment. Therefore, I think that we're shooting ourselves in the foot with strong migration. Okay. CDIA is linked to your COMC trading account for settlement of a trade. Okay, so it's a broking account. Rodney, so far as I understand it, broking accounts are not actually regarded in the same category as deposit accounts, but that has never been tested at law, so be careful. When I had Harry Dent come and talk here in Australia, his advice was, if you want to be sure about the money, you know, broking accounts from organisations that do not have a banking licence as well, so ComC might not be a good example, is actually quite a good way to go. Now, I've never found out whether there are any in Australia, but that might be worth exploring, because basically they would not be seen as deposits because they're not ADIs. I think an account that's linked to an ADI will be more problematic and might actually be caught. TLA says more desalination plants. Yeah, but well, you can make desal energy neutral. But of course, there's a big construction cost and a big carbon bill when you actually build them. Yeah, and Gold Silver Crypto says there's news that the government wants to buy back bushfire-prone properties on the ABC. New megacities might be coming ahead of the light rail project. Yeah, so there's a really interesting discussion there, right? We have we've allowed a lot of development in and around the bush. I mean, I live in an area which has got green all the way around. makes a nice place to live until you think about the bushfire risk. But there are people who are actually now, you know, who've been burned out, and the question is, should they be allowed to rebuild? I think that's a really interesting and complex conversation. It may well be that the right answer is actually to be a little bit more cautious about what you can build and where you can build it. But I'm also very worried about the concept of just creating a small number of mega cities and just, you know, collecting everybody together and squeezing them into high-rise buildings, and, you know, because the quality of life is the thing that I think we need to come back to. And that's why I made the point earlier on, right? So measuring success by GDP is missing the point. I think we should be measuring things like quality of life and all those sorts of things. You know, for the last 6 weeks, I've been breathing smoke-ridden air here in near Wollongong. Last couple of days, it's cleared, but for weeks, it's been awful. And that should register somehow on the scale of, you know, pluses and minuses in terms of the way the economy is assessed. It's not. It's just regarded as nature, you know. I think that's rubbish. There were mistakes made. There are people that should take responsibility. So to my mind, we need a different set of metrics around measuring what really is, you know, success looks like. So success to me is more about quality of life. And that may well mean that we should still allow people to construct, you know, places to live further away from those big urban centres. But nevertheless, tighter rules, regulations, and probably not so far into the bush as many are built at the moment. Okay. We're doing 9:20. Gee, time flies when you're enjoying yourself. I've only done the first page of my questions. Very good from Golden Shickles. They call them smart cities because if you call them gulags, they could not sell them. Yeah, very, very good point. You look at some of the high-rise construction and look at the small size of the rooms, and even things like noise between one floor and the other floor. It's horrendous. I mean, you know, some of the places that I've visited quite recently have been modern, but the noise one floor to the next floor is something you wouldn't find in an older style of development. So I think it's a big deal. Vincent says, CPI test. Everybody asks themselves, compare your payslip from 2-3 years ago and compare this to petrol, fuel, electricity, council rates, insurance bills for the last same period. Absolutely. Well, you know, I asked that in my financial confidence index, Vincent, and it's absolutely astonishing. I think something like 95% of people said basically the cost of living have risen. And then you say, what about your incomes? No, there's hardly any growth. So absolutely, it is one of the biggest issues we've got here. We've had no real income growth for many people since, you know, 10 years ago, and yet costs are running through the roof. It's a big deal. Dark Helmet says, I'm 110 minutes late. Sorry about that, but you can still watch it on replay, and you're still on for the last few minutes. Okay, I'm just going to have a quick look and see what else I've got in terms of questions. So we'll look. Okay, let me just go back to there. So this is from Phil. Real estate listings are way down. How will real estate agencies survive? I don't believe the hype about large sales volumes. I have three agencies, I assume in the local area rather than owning them, who are still closed following Christmas. Yeah, this is a real big issue. It's quite clear to me that we have low listing volumes. We also have low sales transaction volumes. And in fact, Edwin made this post today. The next questions are, will property portals increase advertising costs more? And if so, more pain to the real estate offices? And how closer are we to property portals launching as real estate offices? Almost 50% down on sales listings, out of revenues. So the point there is that we have a significant issue in the real estate sector. There are many real estate agents who are not actually selling enough. They are actually reliant on maybe managing rentals, but of course rentals are actually a bit under pressure as well, or indeed trying to convince people to run auctions because they get a bit of money for the cost of the auctions. I think the real estate sector, according to my surveys, is in significant pressure and in significant decline. Now, there were a few locations where it's pretty good, so particularly the upper end, you know, around Sydney and around Melbourne, but actually many people in the suburban areas and in the regional areas are up against at the moment. Sales volumes are very low. The costs of sales, you know, are potentially rising. So, yeah, I think we're going to see a real big shakeout. Now, Johnny asks, if you've paid off your home mortgage, is it a good idea to get back the titles from the bank or just leave it in their hands? Well, so there's 2 points. The first is that if you ever thought you want another mortgage, you know, you've already gone through half the process, but they'll still have to go through the same process again. My own position is that getting the mortgage off, of course, it's an electronic title these days, so you don't get physical documents. But my own view is, why would you have the bank on your deeds if you don't actually have any liability? Okay, now just see what else I've got. Okay, this is from Stephen. It's quite a good question, actually. A question for tonight's QA. 6 months ago, you interviewed Lynette Zhang, who believes hyperinflation is just around the corner, which will result in a reset of the financial system, and the best way to protect ourselves is through owning physical gold. How does this compare with the views of Harry Dent, who you also interviewed? What's your take on it? Thanks in advance, and keep up the good work. Stephen, that's a great question. So, 2 points to make. It's interesting that both Lynette and Harry both see a meltdown in the financial system at some point. And the cause of that is pretty much the same. It's basically too much debt in the system, bad management, all of those things. But their solutions are actually quite interestingly different. So Harry actually has a view of gold probably falling in value considerably, whereas Lynette believes that gold is going to be the last bastion and is basically going to be the way to go. So there's two ways to pair this apart. Firstly, I showed you in my scenarios, I am not somebody who's in the doomsday camp with regard to the total financial system, right? If you look at those probabilities, a lot of the issues that I spoke about were local issues rather than global issues. So, yeah, there's a significant chance that the Fed could go wrong, Europe could go wrong, China could go wrong. But nevertheless, it's not, to my mind, an absolute certainty. So that's the first point. The second is then, is gold really as good as some people say? Well, I've made the point earlier on. Gold, of course, is linked to the derivatives as well as the underlying. It's multiple derivatives relative to the underlying. And therefore, the value of gold is highly manipulated. You've got many large operators, including investment banks and other people, manipulating the price of gold. So don't assume that gold is somehow the silver bullet, the risk-free alternative. It's not. Gold does have certain characteristics, but one of them is you can't do anything with it, right? You've got to sell it if you want to actually convert it to something which is valuable to, you know, to go buy carrots at the shop. Right? Imagine taking a gold bar in and trying to buy a load of carrots. So you've always got the conversion issues. Harry's view is that we will see a correction, and it will be a big one, but it won't necessarily be straight away. And he talks about the fact that we could well see more run-ups and then sort of going sideways, more run-ups, going sideways, but at some point it will drop. And when it will drop significantly, and it will drop a long, long way. And his view is that gold will be caught. So they have different views. As I say, my own view is that the doomsday scenarios that they're talking about, it's worth considering, but don't overreact to those, because there are lots of other scenarios, as I showed, that are also potentially there as well. Yeah, and Megan says they print money out of nothing. It won't completely crash. It'll be a controlled recession. They still want to keep control. I think that's right. I think that they will assume that they can actually, and I'm talking here the central banks ultimately, that they can actually control this to an extent. So it will be, you know, a slowdown, a grind. So my scenarios are about a long grind rather than a crash. And it's a question of how severe the grind is as to where we end up with regard to house prices, right? That's how I think about it. So I'm not somebody who thinks that we're going to wake up tomorrow afternoon and the whole thing will have fallen over. Could be wrong, but that's my own view at the moment. So Rolf said, send me some of your worthless gold. Yeah, very good. Jamie says, what alternatives do we have to the banks? Well, it depends what you want from the bank, right? So if in fact getting a mortgage, you can get a mortgage from credit unions, building societies. I basically say to people, have you looked at credit unions and building societies? A lot of them are actually offering better rates. They've got better service and a better reputation, and they're not so motivated by profits relative to the big guys. So I tend to look at those. The non-banks, some of them offer mortgages, but of course there the point is that the rates they offer is are often quite a lot higher. With regard to holding money, say if you've got money deposits, you know, you put them in the bank, risk of bail-in, maybe. Broking accounts is what Harry Dent talks about as the best alternative, particularly for the short term. People will talk about gold as an alternative, but I've told you what I think about gold and indeed silver. Or indeed, I suppose, you hold notes out of the system. The point is, though, any class of assets that you hold has risks attached. So there's no risk-free alternative. They've all got different risks, some more so, some less so. And that's the thing that people need to understand, right? We are in a risk-on environment. You know, whether you hold stocks, bonds, shares, cash, gold, whatever. I'm afraid that risk is part of the story. And then the question is, well, are you out to try and maximize your security, in other words, not lose anything on the downside, or are you trying to maximize the growth potential and particularly, you know, take advantage if, in fact, we get a cycle down and a cycle up? So it depends on the objectives that you have, I think, as well as part of that. But no, there are various alternatives. But I do say to people, look at those building societies and credit unions, the mutual sector in Australia. It's an underdeveloped sector. It's a sector that people don't fully understand, but I think it's definitely worth looking at, and I like the culture that they have there. Now, DIY has asked a few times, any chance the Australian government will do land expropriations like South Africa? I don't think so. There's been some issues with Aboriginal land and land deals and those sorts of things. So if you go back in history, basically the assumption was that the land here in Australia was not owned by anybody. So basically the people who landed here then sort of claimed it. But they've given some of that back to some of the Aboriginals. But beyond that, I'm probably not. But, you know, we touched on a little earlier ago the issue about buying people out for bush-prone areas. But that's more from a security perspective, I think. Gold, silver, crypto says, I never swear to anybody who loves cash like Cookie Boy. At this rate, I'm going to start supporting the cash band. Very good. Now, just on the cash band before I finish, it's 9:31. You may have noticed that I put a post out today on the DFA channel, and that is a 5-minute video with the best bits from the hearings that happened on the 12th of December. There's another hearing on the 30th of January in Sydney. That's now confirmed. You can get the details off the site. I believe that a good number of people will be there to hear the evidence. And, you know, if you're in around the area, go and join the party. It'll be an interesting conversation. It'll also show that we're serious about trying to resist the cash ban, because this thing is all about removing civil liberties and stopping us doing things that we can do today. So if you've not seen my post tonight, earlier on today, I used the 5-minute piece that Robbie Barwick from the CC had put together. It's just the snapshots from the hearing, when basically all of the witnesses couldn't answer the questions and showed that there's no basis for the cash ban, there's no rationale behind it. The 10K was just a number plucked out of the air. It's ridiculous. So just a little thought. All right. Well, I've got to 9:32 and I've only done half my questions, but I think that's probably about as much as I can do. Cookie Boy says, Trump wins the next election, Dow will go to 35,000. It will, I'm sure. Watch for Trump's tax mark two. I'm sure we're going to see more tax cuts in and around the election cycle. I don't think you'll get him beached, by the way. That'll just be a sideshow. All right. Megan says, can I mirror the video? Yes, you can. All the links are there, so feel free. Spread it as widely as you can. That 5-minute video, the idea is, what we want to do, this is to do with the cash ban again, we want to get all of the senators and all of the members of parliament to watch this 5 minutes, because it is just so shameful. So spread the word any way you like, the more the merrier. All right, so I think that's pretty much it. So let me just do the closing remarks. I'll have to come back some of these questions. I'll do a separate show and just cover them separately. There's some really good questions, but I just can't do it all. Okay, so just in terms of, if you want more information about DFA and what we do, our blog contains a load of information. We post every day. All of the links and supporting evidence and information for all the posts are actually on the DFA blog. So you might want to sign up. You can also get alerts directly from the DFA blog. We also go via Twitter as well. So that's worth bearing in mind. You can support our work. So one of the things that I say is that we don't do this because we're trying to make money out of it. We don't make any money out of the DFA stuff. We do appreciate those who support us. It helps us to make great content. We've got plans to take the channel further and do a bunch of other things. We've got lots of new other interviews planned and things like that. So if you want to support us regularly, the Patreon opportunity is there. There are various tiers that you can actually subscribe to, and you get access to some specific and special extra content depending on the tier that you go for. Or via PayPal if you want to make a one-off donation. The PayPal facility is there. That's used by a few people. Thank you for those who actually have supported us either via Patreon or via PayPal. It makes a hell of a difference to us to be able to do what we do, and it really is appreciated. And we also do Bitcoin. I had a lot of people say, do Bitcoin. Hasn't really turned out to be a huge money spinner, but nevertheless, it's there if people want to use the facility. It's there. Just in terms of top hits, the housing affordability sucks. Post from yesterday, that's the demographic one. If you've not seen it, watch that. That tells you a lot about where we are relative to other people in other countries. The cash countdown, again, going through the evidence from that 12th of December hearing and what you can do. I did a post on the first-time buyer deposit scheme, which was very well received. I think that people need to be really cautious about the first buyer scheme. There's some warnings in that video. I did a big post on the real cost of the bushfires, where I tried to estimate what it was really going to cost. And I think that's an important post because of the economic impacts. The reason I'm focusing on the bushfires and, you know, the climate-related issues is because I think this is a really important issue for Australia. And, you know, this is a wake-up call in my mind. But it also has massive economic impact directly on us and could actually be one of the most significant events, I think, in the next 20 or 30 years. I've also got various other posts. So there's a Sensible Centre conversation I had with Tara Brooker, journalist. Tara and I have had a few conversations about sort of the intersection between finance, politics and economics. It's been quite interesting. And, of course, John Adams and I continue to make shows on the Interest of the People channel. Our last one was Deposit Insurance is No Protection Against Bank Bail-In Risk. And that's to do with the deposit bail-in. There's another post coming in the next couple of days on that channel relating specifically to the terms and conditions. I had a question tonight on that, where we take those terms and conditions into more detail. And I think that's pretty much it. Okay. So I want to say thank you very much for your time tonight. It really has been great to have so many people on. Pretty appreciate it. Please like the show. Please share it. It's really important that we get some of these messages out. We'll be doing another show in February. We do it on the third Tuesday because that's when the Reserve Bank minutes come out. So we'll cover the same sort of issues, but we'll also, you know, look at the latest data and also be happy to answer any questions on any dimension that you want to explore. I always put an alert out a few days earlier so that you can send me questions beforehand so I can research if necessary. So I want to say thank you very much for your time tonight. Really appreciate it. Have a good evening. Wish you the very best for 2020. It's going to be a really interesting year. I hope that you stay safe. The bushfires don't come near you. And those who actually have been impacted by the bushfires, I hope you are recuperating and recovering well. And stay safe. And keep an eye on those indices. Keep an eye on our posts. We'll try and keep you up to date with what's going on. A lot of data coming over the next few weeks, and we'll be able to cover a lot of it on the channel. So this is Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics saying thanks for watching, and we'll see you again next time.